Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this next segment of our show, we'll hear from Karen McKay from CELA. So tell me a little bit about CELA.
So CELA is the Center for Equitable Library Access, and we are Canada's most comprehensive accessible reading services. We provide books and other materials to Canadians with print disabilities in the formats of their choice. We serve about 97% of the estimated 3 million Canadians with print disabilities through public libraries. And in the next couple of days, we'll be launching our new website. And after that, fully functional, we'll be able to offer a suite of digital services to all Canadians with print disabilities. So we'll serve 100% of Canadians with print disabilities.
So for those who might not be as familiar with the term print disability, could you walk me through that?
Sure. So print disabilities encompass three different types of disabilities. People with low vision or blindness, people who have learning disabilities that prevent them from being able to read and understand a book, or people with physical disabilities that prevent them from being able to hold or manipulate a traditional book. So that might be someone, for example, with maybe Parkinson's or cerebral palsy. So those are the three categories of people that we serve. The Canadian Copyright Act actually has a clause in it that allows us to produce and distribute accessible reading materials. And in that clause, there's a definition that outlines who we can serve. So Canadians with print disabilities, there are about 3 million of them across the country.
So how do you go about spreading the word about the work you do?
Excellent question. So when we were initially established in 2014, we grew out of the CNIB Library for the Blind. And so a large number of our patrons are legacy patrons from the CNIB Library. So we have a large contingent that are that have visual disabilities of some sort. But we also serve those other categories that I spoke about. And so we reach out via newsletters, we reach out through social media, we reach out through people who might influence those other Canadians. So, for example, we have an Educators Access program that allows teachers to access materials on behalf of their students. And we have another program called Client Access, which allows professionals like therapists to access materials on behalf of their patrons or their clients. So we do our best to reach out to as many different sectors that might be able to help us spread the word as possible. We are probably one of Canada's best kept secrets because our services are free. They're offered through public libraries, and the libraries help us promote those services as well. But I'm thrilled to be able to come and chat with you about it because we'd like more people to be able to access our services.
So what are some of the major challenges in creating reading material for those with a print disability?
Oh, we could go on for hours about that. The challenges are sort of multifaceted. Our goal is eventually to put ourselves out of business. What we'd love is for publishers to produce materials that are what's called born accessible, and so that they at publication are available in a variety of formats for all Canadians to read, not just those who read traditional print. But that's not the case right now. So we have materials that are produced in a variety of formats. There's sort of three key formats. One of them is Audio Daisy, And so that's mostly human narrated audio. So that involves having somebody read the book in a studio and record it. We also have e-text, and that's how we distribute information, usually newspapers or different types of books. EPUB books is one that we offer. And then we also have embossed Braille or print Braille and electronic Braille. So with all those different formats, the way we produce those materials is a bit challenging.
So I could just say,
for example, we have a large embossing Braille machine that actually prints a book. So if you request a Braille book, we print a copy just for you. So we will take the electronic file and print it in Braille. If you request a DAISY CD, we download the DAISY CD or the DAISY file onto a CD and mail it. From the publishers, we get a variety of different types of files, which we manipulate to make them accessible. And sometimes we read the book and record it. So there's a variety of ways we produce material.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time with CELA, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Any successful moments that stand out?
Yes.
Well, over the last little while, we've introduced a number of new services. So single embossed Braille, for example, is one of them. So what used to happen is that you would request a Braille book, it would be printed, we would send it to you, you would read it, send it back, and then the next patron that wanted it would receive it after you were finished with it. Now we print a fresh copy for every patron, so there's less delay. Braille, as you know, would wear out over time as people read, the dots start to get worn down, and so you get a fresh copy each time you you want to read a book. So that's just something that we introduced in the past year. As I said, we're just launching our website, so that's a big accomplishment for us. And another big one was we introduced 150 DAISY magazines to our collection, so they're ready to be read on the day they're published, at the same time you see them on the newsstand at the grocery store. And that material used to take quite a long time to transcribe or cord, and so now it's great that if you want to read The New Yorker, you can read this, you know, this current edition as on the same day that it's published. So those are three big achievements that we've had.
So if you could send any message to the community about why this work matters and why more material needs to be accessible, what would you say?
Well, we know that access to reading material directly impacts people's ability to improve their education, improve their economic situation, and it's vital for community connection, mental health. It's a fabulous pastime, and because our patrons do share some level of disability, books are really a fabulous way for them to, to relax, to enjoy themselves. So the number of materials that are produced each year in accessible formats is roughly 1/10 of what's available to the general public. And if libraries had to produce those materials on their own, or if patrons had to buy them, that represents a huge cost. So for us to be able to provide them through a library service, so it's free for patrons, we give people access to 650,000 titles that they otherwise would not be able to access. And that's everything from fiction, nonfiction. We have different languages. We have books for kids and teens as well as adults. We have award winners. So basically what we offer, a service very similar to your neighborhood library service, and we allow people with print disabilities to participate in the conversations, the national conversations that are important to us all.
So do you work in partnership with the education system to any extent?
Well, we have what we call the Educator Access Program. So that allows teachers to borrow books on behalf of their students so that they are able to provide them in a classroom setting or be able to provide them on some sort of technology that the students might access from home. So really this levels the playing field so that all kids, regardless of how they read, are able to participate in their classroom discussions, in their education, in their learning. We do programs for teachers to help them learn about more accessibility issues. So we do webinars and that sort of thing. We meet with teachers. We have an education advisory group so that they can let us know what's happening in their field and help us make sure that we are preparing materials that are appropriate for the students and that meet their needs. And this is key for us. So there, you know, we provide material similar to a public library. So if a student or a classroom, for example, wants to participate in something like Forest of Reading, which is a library program, or they want to participate in a Canada Reads type program in their classroom, we have those books available in a variety of formats so that all the kids can participate and the teachers have access to those materials so that they don't have to single out patrons and or kids and say, I don't have the right book for you, you'll have to read this one instead. So it's really, it levels the playing field and prepares kids for their education.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
This accessible library, my friends, brilliant concept, because what it comes down to is the right to access and the right to education. Who is anyone in society to say, because you view the world a little differently, we're not going to create reading material for you? Thereby, we're not going to let you grow beyond a certain point, to learn and to evolve, as is the fundamental right of every human being. Truth is, people with disabilities can only recognize their full potential if they're given the pathway to get to their full potential. They're like anyone in society. Given the right tools, the right opportunities, they can, they will succeed. However, imposing this glass ceiling because we don't want to take the time or the trouble to make an audio book or to braille something, it's just, it's lazy and it's bad practice on the part of society. And it's contrary to what we all say about, oh, we're an inclusive world and we want to embrace these people into our society. This is so. Equal opportunities and equal access are paramount. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
From March 1st to 31st, Canada will celebrate the Rendez-vous de la Francophonie, RVF. At that time of the year, get to know your Francophone neighbors. Francophone communities are present in every province and territory. RVF gives us the opportunity to get to know one another through celebration, exhibition, theater, and community activities. Linguistic duality is not only an important Canadian characteristic, it is fundamental and necessary for our continued vivre ensemble, our living together. The very existence of our country relies on this powerful tool, the continued presence of Francophone and Anglophone communities across the entire country. In this year, where we will commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Official Languages Act, let's focus on our desire to pursue and strengthen this very unique relationship between our linguistic communities.
Visit rvf.ca for more information.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Karen McKay, from CELA. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Ken Pope, who will be telling us a little bit about what advice should be given to trustees who are responsible for looking after the finance of someone with a disability. So in regards to those who are entrusted as caregivers, or trustees, rather, what advice would you give them about how to manage the finances for someone with a disability?
Well, the first thing I would say is, if you know that one day you'll become the trustee for a family member, a brother, or a sister, perhaps, you should ask your parents to write a letter of wishes for you, which is a kind of a memorandum giving you insight into the things that they presently do for that child and that child's own aspirations. And then you should, you know, invite the parents to have the child who's going to be the beneficiary of the trust to give them insight into what they would like to do too, because that's, of course, what they're going to raise with you when the parents are gone. And rather than have some antagonism between siblings or family members, it would be a lot better for the child to speak to the parents and then the parents to articulate what it is of the child's own aspirations, which may or may not be reasonable within the terms of the trust to actually carry out. So the whole purpose, of course, would be to have greater insight on the part of the trustee as to what the parents are doing now, what the trustee will continue to do for that child, and also what would the aspirations be, because, of course, there are things that the parents couldn't do themselves now. They might wish to do, but they couldn't do because they don't have the assets or the income to do it while alive.
So
once they've passed on, there may well be some lump sum trust in a fund in the trust, which would generate enough income and be enough capital to carry out those greater wishes.
So
a letter of wishes from the parents, input from the beneficiary if that's appropriate, and some guidance as to what of those things the parent would actually like the trustee to carry out and which they would not.
So,
and that'll save a whole lot of argument in the future, I think.
So, out of curiosity, are there any things that a trust is prevented from being used for if a person inherits?
No. There's no restrictions. There are some ways of using the fund in order to minimize any impact it might have on ODSP benefits, but there's really nothing, there's no rocket science to it, and there's no limitation as to the amount of the trust or the purposes of the trust or the disbursements from the trust. It's recently settled that the Henson Trust will not affect any other benefits that the child is receiving. The only thing you have to be careful of is not putting too much income in the sense of any payments to the beneficiary too much. For example, the simple rule is in Ontario, the beneficiary can receive $10,000 over 12 months. So obviously you could give them $800 a month, $9,600 a year, with no effect on ODSP. And if it's to be greater than that, if it's for anything that can be categorized as disability-related, and I think there's room for creativity here. For example, vacations in Nevada can be for therapeutic purposes. If you have sad ailments, you become depressed in the dark and the snow, which we all do, of course. But if you want to take a trip to Nevada or trips to Cuba, those could easily be therapeutic and disability-related.
So
there's that. And then beyond that, any amount that needs to be dispersed, what you do is you make your calculation or your budget for the year, and in a given month you disperse it, let's say $30,000, and you're prepaying the difference between the $500 shelter component of ODST and the real rent of $1,300. So you've got $800 a month that the person can't pay, so the trust disperses $800 times 12 once a year every 2 years or every 3 years, however long the person's going to be there.
So
it's given to the property manager. Property manager is ecstatic because they have this huge deposit, and they then apply $800 a month towards rent. Gradually, the deposit reduces, but much time goes by. Everybody's happy, and the only impact on ODSP is that in the month dispersed, it would have resulted in the beneficiary being deemed to be overpaid ODSP for that 1 month's benefit. So their 1 month's benefit of $1,169 has been overpaid, and ODSP then reduces their benefits by $50 a month going forward until the $1,169 is recouped. And if you disperse, $30,000 a year every January to do something, well, every year there's a 1 month overpayment. And, of course, after 12 months, you've only recouped $600. Well, the overpayment grows and grows in this hypothetical scenario, but the $50 a month never changes. It's always $50 a month. So you can see there's really nothing to talk about here.
So Henson Trusts, are they taxable? I know ODSP largely is not, so.
The income generated by the trust on the trust fund, the income earned, would be declared in the hands of the beneficiary because the beneficiary has tax credits, which in 95% of the cases result in no tax being owing. So you attribute it to the beneficiary. You take it off of the trust tax return. You file a zero return for the trust every year, a nil return it's called. And you attribute that, you know, $2,600 of income to the benefit recipient. And they have a personal tax credit, a loan of $12,000, just like everyone else. And if they happen to qualify for the disability tax credit, close to another $9,000. So roughly, say, $20,000 a year. Now, $20,000 a year is 4% income on $500,000. So you can see that unless you have a very substantial trust fund earning income at a reasonable rate, you're never going to pay any taxes.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Glad to.
It's March, my friends, and you know what that means. Time for the ICHA annual soccer tournament. This year's event was a great success, and in the next couple of segments of our show, you're going to hear from some of the volunteers who helped make it possible. This is Cam Wells here with...
Oh, yes. Hi, I'm Spencer Pearson.
And...
Seamus Tokel.
Vanessa Gaddy.
And we're here at the ICHA soccer tournament. So what led you folks to want to be involved?
To be honest, Vanessa asked us, and I like soccer. I like working with these people, and I thought it would be a fun experience.
So is this your first time here? Or?
Yeah,
it's my first time. Well, it's both of our first times.
So what do you think of the overall setup?
It's very organized.
I mean, everyone seems to be having a lot of fun. It's super organized. Everyone knows where they're supposed to be. It's really cool.
So in terms of disability sports, do you find there's enough representation for events like this?
Yeah, I think there's a good amount of representation. There seems to be more and more word is going out, like with radio stations talking about stuff like this. It's really cool getting more events like this. I think people are really appreciating it.
So, do you folks think you'll be involved in future such events, or is this just a one-off?
I'll be involved for sure, because my brother participates in these, and I like watching him play, so I'll help out.
So, in that sense, for athletes like your brother, do you think they put on a good game, their athletic ability is on par with, quote, able-bodied society?
I think they do what they can.
I think
they're doing really well. They're having fun too. So that's good.
So if each of you could send any message to the community about why events like this are important, what would you say?
That was home team.
I think it's important because it's good to have everyone like included in this kind of thing. And like it's really fun. It's always been a fun day. Like I've done these before, and everyone usually enjoys themselves.
And you?
Sorry, what was the question?
If you could send any message about why these events are important, what would you say?
I think these events are important because it's a really good way of accessing community. I think more people need to volunteer for these kinds of events to help reach out to communities that they might not normally reach out to and just have fun. I think these events are all about having fun and everyone appreciates them.
Thank you very much for taking the time out to do this.
Thank you.
This is Cam Wells here with...
Serena Barr.
Jacob Zojak.
Alessia Piazza.
And we're here at the ICHA soccer tournament. So what led you folks to want to volunteer today?
I was actually asked by my best friend, Vanessa. And
nice.
Yeah, me as well.
I do it every year because my Zio's in charge of it.
So do you find events like this put on a good game?
that these athletes put on as good of a performance as their, quote, able-bodied counterparts.
Of course.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And they're fun to watch. They're so excited and hyper, and I love it. They give off such a great energy.
So since it's your first time here, what's your overall impression of what's available for them?
I'm excited, and I want to come back again.
I'm going to probably come back next year, too, or next time, too.
So you could send any message about why events like this are important. What would you say?
I think it shows them that they're so capable, and I think it's a really positive environment, so it's good for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anything to add?
I think it's fun to be here, and it's fun to
like
meet everyone.
What would you hope for the future of these athletes? Do you think events like this should continue? And
oh, my God,
yeah. Sure.
I think they should keep doing it, and I think they should do it every year and keep playing.
Since there are events like this throughout the year, do you folks see yourselves getting involved more and more?
Or? Oh, for sure, for sure. I would do this as much as I can, yeah.
Any thoughts any of you want to add?
24? Thank you.
I think I like the environment. I like how everyone is, like, really good players and, like, good sports. It's pretty good.
I like conversating with them. I was just dancing with number 17 from Woodstock, and he's so funny.
Me too.
And they all start great conversations, and I love them so much. I love talking to them and hanging out with them.
Well, that's the thing. When they're out there, they're not thinking about any quote-unquote limitation. They're just in the moment.
Yeah.
It's a very freeing experience.
It is. It's great. I love it.
Like to thank you all for taking the time out to do this.
Of course.
I wanted to conclude on the high note about the ICHA tournament for today, because really, it was just amazing to see the passion of these people coming together to create an opportunity for individuals with disabilities. Some of them were there for the first time, and they spoke very, very highly about the possibility they'd be back to serve again. And that is because it is really recognizing that you can change a person's life on a dime. A person with a disability may spend their whole lives saying, "I'm not worth it and nobody cares." But the moment they realize their life does have value and meaning, that someone is trying to reach out, even if it's just in their own subtle way, they'll reach back. May take some time, may take some effort, but I maintain there is always a way to reach anyone. Now, that being said, we are the Need It Now generation. Some of us the Need It Yesterday generation. And that means we want instant success, instant gratification, instant what have you. But when it comes to getting to know someone, anyone, whether they have a disability or not, time, patience, these things are essential. No interaction, no relationship is to be undervalued to the point at which we say, yeah, this person doesn't give me what I want to hear or what I need from a business standpoint instantly. I'm not going to deal with them. Getting to know someone is not a part of Need It Now. You need food now. You need water now. You need shelter now. You don't instantly need to think there's a connection. Real friendship, real understanding, real commitment is built on saying, I did a little bit today, and I'm going to do a little bit tomorrow. A little bit more. Before you know it, you've stacked up things pretty high, almost to the point at which you can stand just a little taller for knowing that you're someone who really does believe inequality, who doesn't just say the right things, but puts them to use. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.